Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes 3 times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny died in prison today. We'll hear from a former American diplomat who knew him well.
Let's be crystal clear about this. There's way too much passive tense being used in the discussion of this in the press. Putin killed Navalny.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Egypt is preparing for something it never wanted, the arrival of Palestinian refugees from the Gaza Strip.
Eyewitnesses are saying that tents have been set up in that area and that Egypt is creating a space so that it can host about 100,000 displaced people.
And trying to stop a new generation of state-sponsored hackers.
They're pre-positioning themselves in networks in anticipation of some conflict they're expecting later.
Plus some pretty big soccer news.
All those stories and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Alexei Navalny, Vladimir Putin's biggest critic and Russia's most prominent political opposition leader, has died in prison. The news first came this morning from Russian prison authorities. President Joe Biden spoke about Navalny's death today from the White House.
I just want to say God bless Alexei Navalny. His courage will not be forgotten, and I'm sure it will not be the only courage we see coming out of Russia in the near term.
Biden said Navalny was brave and principled, and he was dedicated to building a Russia where the rule of law applied to everyone.
Alexei Navalny was serving a 19-year prison sentence in an Arctic penal colony. He had decided to return to Russia even after being poisoned in 2020 by a Soviet-era nerve agent. For a while, the authorities moved Navalny around within the penal colony system. Even his lawyers weren't told where he was at times. Navalny appeared to be well aware that his life was at risk, but he found a way to talk about that in a documentary.
My message for the situation when I'm killed is very simple. Not give up.
Do me a favor. Answer this one in Russian.
И здесь у меня просто очевидная вещь. Ну, не сдавайтесь.
Switching to Russian, he said, you're not allowed to give up. We don't realize how strong we actually are. Michael McFaul is a professor at Stanford University, and he served as U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. He got to know Alexei Navalny over the years. We caught Ambassador McFaul earlier today on the phone in Munich, Germany, where he's attending an international security conference. I asked him about his reaction to the news of Navalny's death.
I was shocked. I couldn't believe it at first. I wanted not to believe it because there was some reporting that it may not be true. I'd just seen his wife last night, Julia. Mm-hmm. She's a friend of mine. We were planning her trip to Stanford so that she could see her daughter, Dasha, graduate this spring. And we were supposed to meet later today to talk about what was going on in the opposition. So I was in complete shock and just horrific news today.
You say you were in shock, but was there part of you that expected this to happen eventually?
No. I want to be honest with you. I knew him for a long time. He was an incredibly courageous human being, fighting for freedom for his country. Last time we corresponded by email was the day before he went back to Russia, and he was very strong, both psychologically and physically, when he got on that plane. And he has remained under incredibly horrific, barbaric circumstances, strong and jovial and joking whenever we get clips of him. I always thought that he would outlive Putin. Turned out that I was wrong.
And I just want to clarify that he went back to Russia after being poisoned.
Putin tried to kill him in 2020. And let's be crystal clear about this. There's way too much passive tense being used in the discussion of this in the press. Putin killed Navalny.
We spoke with one of Navalny's doctors today, and he told us that given the circumstances of Navalny's imprisonment, that, you know, his body couldn't withstand it. He thought it might have been natural causes, you know, triggered by the conditions of that imprisonment, or he may have been murdered. Do you have an opinion on that?
I think it's a distinction without a difference. Obviously, doctors need to decide that, and I'm not a doctor, and we need more details, although we're unlikely to get them out of Putin's Russia. But make no mistake, the last time I saw Alexei Navalny, he was an incredibly healthy, vigorous man, physically and emotionally and intellectually. They were slowly trying to kill him in jail, and they couldn't break him down where they were holding him in the last place. So they shipped him to an even more horrific place. I got the gory details from his wife last night about his imprisonment, just inhuman conditions.
Can you share some of that, what Yulia told you about the conditions of his imprisonment at the end?
Well, they moved him. Remember, we didn't know where he was for several days. Mm-hmm. They finally moved him up to this place way up north. He was in solitary confinement, almost no contact with other humans. His space for walking was just another cell without a roof. His reading was constrained. Evidently, he had to listen to a radio that blasted all the time without his control that piped in Putin's speeches. So this was torture. They were torturing this man, slowly trying to break him down.
Is there any sense of why this might have happened now? You know, the timing is strange. There's about to be an election, which Putin will easily win. You know, the Munich Security Conference is right now, and this, I imagine, is taking over the topic of conversation. Any thoughts on that?
All I would say is this. I've known Putin for a long time, too. I think there's this myth in the West that we need to stop propagating, which is that Putin is strong, Putin is popular, he's confident, and everything's just fine back at home, and that's why he can conduct his barbaric war against Ukraine. I see a very different Putin. This is a weak leader. You don't need to kill your adversaries if you're strong. You don't need to remove people like Boris Nadezhdin, somebody else I know, who is trying to run for president in a very controlled way just to give this election some more legitimacy. He had to remove him from the ballot. So to me, these are signs of desperation from Mr. Putin. And this is one more. I mean, the one guy in Russia that inspired more opposition and emotion and hope was Alexei Navalny. And so even in a prison cell, dying in a prison cell, that threat seemed too much for Mr. Putin.
You say that the Western view or maybe handling of Putin is misguided. What, if anything, could have been done to stop this from happening?
Well, I just think analytically we think Putin's strong and there's nothing we can do. And I just disagree with that. I think we should think harder about ways to weaken Putin inside his country. The Western world has frozen $360 billion of assets from the Russian government. Give that money to Ukraine. That would be a sign that you're trying to weaken Mr. Putin. Our House of Representatives, for reasons that are mysterious to me, are blocking aid to Ukraine. That is a gift to Mr. Putin. Let's be very clear about that. If you are not giving Ukrainian warriors on the battlefield ammunition they need to fight against Putin's invading, occupying soldiers, that is a gift to Mr. Putin, and hand over the money we've already frozen. I mean, can you imagine a U.S. president or a German chancellor getting up to in front of their voters to say, well, in the name of some abstract thing called the liberal international order, we're going to give this money back to Putin? That's never going to happen. And I know that Alexei Navalny would want those things to be done.
Navalny said in 2022 that, quote, if they decide to kill me, it means that we are incredibly strong, talking about the opposition there. What does his death mean for the opposition in Russia? Will this galvanize or further instill fear in those who oppose Putin?
Both. And I think we need to be able to say both will be true at the same time. So if you're a college kid living in Moscow today, and you hate Putin, there's data to suggest that that's the demographic that does not support Putin. You're not going to go out tomorrow and demonstrate because you don't want to go to jail and you don't want to die in prison. But we should make no mistake that those people, and there are millions of them, not just small handfuls, that don't like this regime, that abhor this horrific war in Ukraine. This will be a sign that this regime has no future for them.
Ambassador McFaul, I wonder if there's a particular moment with Alexei Navalny or a memory you have of him that you've been replaying in your head today or that you will remember fondly going forward.
Well, I would say two things. I mean, one, I've had the privilege in my life to meet some incredibly courageous people around the world, Russia, Belarus, Iran, China, South Africa, even going way back. And there are few people that I have met who had the courage and conviction of Alexei Navalny. Now, he had his faults and he said things that I disagreed with, but this was a man committed to making his country free and a better place. And I cannot think of other people in the world that I've had the privilege of knowing who had the same conviction. So this is a loss, not just for his family and the Russian opposition. This is a loss for anybody that cares about freedom, that cares about liberty, that cares about democracy. We've lost, in my view, one of the great leaders that we have around the world fighting for these things. That's the first thing. The second thing I would just say is he came, you know, his daughter goes to school at Stanford. He came out to Stanford just like all parents do on admit day. I remember walking by, he's a tall, handsome guy. And the Stanford band, which is kind of wacky and kooky, was playing. And he was just smiling in the sun, watching them. Nobody knew who he was except for me. And I walked over and he was so proud of his daughter. And he should be, because she's fantastic. And he just said, "Mike, the hardest thing that I am doing," this is before he was poisoned, this is before he was imprisoned. He said, "The hardest thing I have to do in my job is to be an absent father." And he just said, you know, we want Dasha to not live in Russia at the time. This is his daughter who goes to Stanford. We are grateful that she'll be here in a safe place to live a normal life. And do what you can to help me deal with that guilt that he has and about being the absent father. And he's sent that message to me many times. And I think about that on this really horrible day.
Michael McFaul was an ambassador to Russia. Ambassador, thank you so much for sharing your memories of Alexei Navalny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Rachel Kundananji is known at home in Zambia as the Copper Queen, the country's Wonder Woman of soccer.
It is Rachel Kundananji with her second goal in two games.
The 23-year-old forward has now earned another impressive title, the most expensive player in the history of women's soccer.
Hello, everyone. My name is Rachel Kundananji. I'm super excited to join BFC.
This week, Kundananji left Madrid's CFF for San Francisco's new team, Bay FC, and she fetched a record-breaking transfer fee of nearly $800,000. The deal is the first time any African soccer player has broken a world transfer record.
The regular season for the National Women's Soccer League starts on March 16th. Kundananji will be with the San Francisco team for at least 4 years. She told Zambia's Soccer Federation she's focused and ready to start.
I'm just looking forward, you know, to meet my new family, my new team, and to do more because I need to reach my target.
That target she's talking about is to be the league's top scorer. We've got more soccer news later in the show about the French footballer Kylian Mbappe's decision to leave his hometown team in Paris.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Egypt is preparing for something it was hoping to avoid. Israeli leaders are planning for a possible major ground offensive into the southern Gaza city of Rafah. More than a million displaced Palestinians are now crowded into Rafah, which sits right on the border with Egypt. That means any significant Israeli military operation there could send thousands of Palestinians across the border. Since the start of the war in Gaza, Egypt has said it does not want Palestinian refugees entering the country. But that stance might now be changing. The Royal Shirin Jafari is following all this.
The Egypt-Gaza border is about 7 miles long, and it's a really crucial place, Carol, because it's one of only two ways people in Gaza can enter or leave. There is another border crossing through Israel, which has been closed since October 7th. This one has been closed too. Only some humanitarian aid and a limited number of people have been able to cross since the war began. And now there's even more attention today because there is some new activity there. Eyewitnesses are saying that tents have been set up in that area and that Egypt is creating a space so that it can host about 100,000 displaced people.
That's a big change.
Yeah, and I've been in touch with a group called the Sinai Foundation for Human Rights. And they're based in the UK and they are a monitoring group. They showed a video from that border area that shows a crane lifting concrete walls into place. You can also see in that video, Carol, that there are trucks moving concrete around and there's earth being moved around as well. And the Sinai Foundation says that Egypt is building a security buffer zone in that area just in case people start to flee Rafah right across the border. And besides the video and the eyewitness accounts, there are some new satellite images that confirm what the Sinai Foundation is saying, that there are new activities there, land is being cleared, and walls are being erected.
So what's the significance of this?
Well, Egypt has been worried about a possible offensive by Israeli military in the city of Rafah. Israel has been saying it wants to carry out this offensive because it wants to clear the city of Hamas militants. And today at the Munich Security Conference, Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, says that there are no plans to deport Palestinians from Gaza. But the problem is that the city of Rafah has about 1.5 million displaced people in it. And these are people who have been told by the Israeli military to move there because it's safer than other places in the Gaza Strip. Now they're being told they need to move again.
So has Egypt acknowledged what it's doing at the border?
So the Egyptian officials are not confirming that they're doing this. But again, since the beginning of the war, they've been saying that they don't want any Palestinians displaced from Gaza into Egypt. You know, Egypt is concerned that Israel would not let them go back once they're in Egypt. Egypt also says that it's concerned about security in the Sinai area. It says it doesn't want Hamas militants to relocate there and cause problems. And it's been so insistent on this issue, Carol, that Egypt even threatened to leave a peace treaty that it signed with Israel in 1979. So it really takes this issue seriously.
So what exactly has changed for Egyptian authorities if they're now creating this buffer zone?
We don't exactly know. Some media reports are saying that Egypt might have been offered some sort of financial or other incentives, or it might have been pressured by Israel to take some Palestinian refugees. We just don't know yet. It might also be just creating these holding places for Palestinians just in case it needs it, just as a sort of assurance.
The Royal Shirin Jafari updating us on the situation at the border between Egypt and Gaza.
Fans of Paris Saint-Germain are really going to miss this sort of thing from their hometown hero, Kylian Mbappe.
Got to find Mbappe now. He'll steer back inside. Thuram! Mbappe!
The 25-year-old grew up in Paris, and that is where he cemented his reputation as one of the best soccer players in the game today. But on Thursday, news broke that Mbappe has decided to leave the Paris team. There's no shortage of rumors about which club he'll go play for at the end of the season. Tariq Panja is a sports writer with the New York Times. He's been following Mbappe since his early days as a teenage superstar.
I can't say it's that much of a surprise because it's been this kind of soap opera for the last couple of years, at least, that Kylian Mbappe is feeling like he needs to move on, take his talent to another stage outside of France for the first time in his career. Real Madrid has always been talked about as the team of his dreams when he was a child. And if you look at the soccer firmament, where does Real Madrid sit? It sits right at the top.
So there are rumors flying around about where he might be going next. Obviously, you've mentioned Real Madrid. Is that the most likely place or what else? Which other teams might be in contention?
So, yeah, Real Madrid is the most likely place. However, the issue is where else? And where else doesn't kind of work because of math, basically. He's playing at a team in Paris that is owned by the state of Qatar. They open a gas and oil spigot and pay for football players. Real Madrid, for all their star power, it can't do that. So the chances are he will not be getting the type of money that he's on at Paris Saint-Germain should he go there. But he does get the cachet of playing for that team.
Yeah, let's talk money. How much is he making now and how much of a pay cut do you think he's going to have to take to go play for the team of his dreams?
You're looking at estimates of up to 200 million euros per season. This number is enormous, really, even in those vaunted football circles. You know, you've seen these numbers dished out by Saudi Arabia, for example, because he will be a free agent. Paris Saint-Germain cannot command a fee for him, which is the norm in European and world soccer. If a player is under contract, you could extract tens of millions of dollars, if not for someone of Kylian Mbappe's talent. You know, you're talking about close to $200 million, perhaps. Paris Saint-Germain could have asked a suitor. But because he's a free agent, all of the money is going to Kylian Mbappe in his pocket.
So, Tariq, what makes Mbappe such a special player?
He's just got all of these attributes that you want in a top-class striker, a forward. He's got this searing pace. He's got maturity that belies his years. He's got incredible ball control, cold eye when it comes to being in front of the goal, and that kind of star power as well, the confidence and the aura around a handful of players. He's kind of the complete package.
Is there a risk here of him moving away from a team where he's had so much success?
Yes, he's won the World Cup. He's been in the World Cup final. What has he not won? He's not won the Champions League. That is the competition for Europe's best team played every year. Real Madrid is a team that is built to win that competition. It knows how to win it. And wearing those white shirts, playing at the Bernabeu in Madrid, that is a step up when it comes to club football. For whatever he could achieve at PSG is the next level for him. And it takes his talent outside of France for the first time. And that's also a challenge. Can he do it in another environment? And having spent a little bit of time with him, we interviewed him a couple of years ago, this guy is not short of ambition. And he's not short of confidence. He'd probably want to try his luck somewhere else.
Tariq Panja is a sports writer with the New York Times, and he joined us from Vancouver, Canada. More stories from across the globe are coming up. You're with The World.
Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum is the ruler of Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Women from the royal family have risked their lives to escape him. That includes Princess Latifa, one of the sheikh's daughters, who fled by boat.
Latifa is identified and is dragged overboard, screaming, "Shoot me now, don't take me back."
Trying to flee from a powerful world leader, ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. No serving leader in the European Union has led their country for as long as Hungary's Viktor Orban. But this week, the Hungarian prime minister faced some of his most turbulent times in office.
Two prominent female politicians, both close allies of Viktor Orban's, were forced to resign. The scandal involves the country's president, the former justice minister, and a man convicted in relation to a child sexual abuse case. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
Katalin Novak, the Hungarian president, has always been loyal to Viktor Orban. She's even been known to wear earrings inscribed with Orban's initials. Novak was one of the few female lawmakers in the Hungarian cabinet before being appointed president in 2022. Orban once said that most women can't handle the stress of political life. And when I put those comments to Novak in Budapest a few years ago, she defended her party leader.
That's true for any leading position, I think, even in the labour market, anywhere in private sector and also in politics. Yes, that's true. I even told it openly at one of our party congresses that, yes, this is a tough life.
In the past week, things got a whole lot tougher for Novak. The controversy goes back to April of last year, when Novak granted a presidential pardon to the deputy director of a state-run children's home. The man was sentenced to 3 years in prison in 2018 for pressuring victims to retract their claims of sexual abuse by the home's director. News of the presidential pardon only emerged last week, and it caused a public outcry. Crowds protested outside the presidential palace in Budapest, and opposition lawmakers like Anna Donath called on Novak to step down.
There's no less what we're expecting than the resignation of the president. I think this is something that she cannot come back.
And last Saturday, live on television, she resigned.
Államfőként ma utoljára szólok önökhöz. Lemondok a köztársasági elnöki tisztségről.
Novak didn't explain why she had granted the pardon, saying only that it was a mistake and she was sorry. Moments later, Judit Varga, the former justice minister who had countersigned the pardon, announced she was resigning too. Orban must have hoped that would put the matter to rest. But the ex-husband of Judit Varga, a former party loyalist, had other ideas. He posted messages on Facebook condemning the party, saying the two women had been sacrificed unfairly. The real culprits, he said, are hiding behind women's skirts. He appeared on an independent news channel the following day, saying Orban's party was rife with corruption. Gábor Géry is an analyst with Policy Solutions, a political research institute in Budapest.
He was making the argument that all of Hungary is now more or less being owned by a few families who are close to the prime minister, and that the way the propaganda machinery operates in Hungary is also unacceptable.
In the last few days, pressure has mounted on two other key figures in Orban's inner circle, including a bishop who lobbied for the presidential pardon to be granted. Giori says right now it looks like Orban will weather the storm. National elections aren't due for another couple of years. But some voters, he says, may exercise the frustration at the ballot box in the upcoming local or European elections.
Maybe they don't want to remove them from power, but these elections would then be an excellent opportunity for warning the government that they must do a better job.
Because many Hungarians are really struggling with the high cost of living right now, he says. Some political experts say members of Orban's own party may be worried by just how quickly these two senior figures were removed from political office. Orban himself hasn't spoken a word in defence of his two former allies. Daniel Hegedusch is with the German Marshall Fund.
Even these two sacrifices raised some question marks in the internal ranks of the Fidesz party, whether party members will really be protected if they are attacked at the political stage, or they will be sacrificed.
Hegedűs thinks Orbán will survive this latest political turmoil too, but he says this has been a really important week for independent media in Hungary that broke the story.
No one ever imagined until last week that a release of a piece of information about the presidential pardon in one of the independent newspapers can lead to such a political earthquake in a semi-authoritarian regime and can lead to the resignation of high-level politicians.
This shows independent journalists that their work really matters, Hegedűs says. Today, more anti-government protests kicked off in central Budapest. Tomorrow, Viktor Orban gives his annual State of the Union address. Independent news outlets in Hungary have been told they're not invited. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Dubai in the United Arab Emirates has a well-earned reputation for ostentatious wealth and rising global influence. But the ruling family in Dubai also has a problem. For years, its ruler has been accused of abusing women.
My name is Latifa Al-Maktoum. I was born on December 5, 1985.
and that includes women in his own family.
My father is the Prime Minister of UAE and the ruler of Dubai, Mohammed bin Rashid Saeed Al Maktoum.
Princess Latifa is one of the Sheikh's daughters, and she's attracted attention worldwide after accusing her father of abuse, torture, and imprisonment. Investigative journalist Heidi Blake has chronicled Princess Latifa's ordeal and that of her sister Shamsa through years of messages and secret recordings that describe her attempts to escape from her father. Blake spoke with me recently about her reporting.
Well, Sheikh Mohammed is the absolute ruler of Dubai, and he's also the Prime Minister of the United Arab Emirates. And he's an autocratic ruler, so he commands absolute power over his people. And I think one of the things that fascinated me about this was at the same time, Sheikh Mohammed has been at pains to present himself on the world stage as a champion of women's rights in the Middle East. So he's on the one hand kind of crushing his own daughters and other women in the family, and then on the other hand, talking about removing all the hurdles women face and championing women and their economic advancement in the UAE.
Now, Latifa spends years preparing for her escape. She takes martial arts classes, she learns to scuba dive, and she befriends people who are not from the UAE, who she thinks can help her. Describe this period of her life and the key people who start helping her with her plan.
Yeah, it's kind of unbelievable that Latifa planned for so long this second escape attempt. She tried to run away the first time when she was 16, and she'd been captured and returned to Dubai and thrown in prison for 3.5 years, where she was held in solitary confinement in the most appalling conditions and tortured by her father's guards.
So she tries to escape when she's 16, is caught, and she's placed in solitary confinement with no contact with people?
That's right. Yeah, she was held in a prison in the desert in a cell all by herself. And she wrote very extensively about how she was held often for days in the dark. She was made to sleep on a filthy, bloodstained mattress. And guards would burst in routinely and beat her. They used to cane the bottoms of her feet so badly that all the bones were shattered. And she talked about how they told her that her father had given them orders to beat her to death.
And so after all this, she then is released, and then she still had the kind of mental well-being and physical strength to plot a second attempt?
Yeah, Latifa's kind of indomitable spirit is something that I found just flabbergasting in all of this. So she wrote a lot to friends as she was contemplating the second escape that she was really agonizing over whether to try to do it again. Because on the one hand, she kind of blamed her sister Shamsa and mistakes that she'd made during her own escape attempt for all the trouble that Latifa had faced since, for the fact that Latifa had felt obligated to run away herself to try to get help for Shamsa, for the fact that Latifa had then suffered years of imprisonment. But after Latifa was released a few years later, Shamsa herself had come out of prison, and Latifa was so devastated by how hollow out Shamsa had been by her ordeal that she just couldn't bear to see Shamsa like that. She said that she was a zombie and a shell of her former self. And she kind of realized that nobody else was going to help them and that she, Latifa, was going to have to try to get away.
So then in her 30s, Latifa wants to make a second attempt to escape. She prepares for years. She takes martial arts classes. She learns to scuba dive. She befriends people who she thinks can help her. Describe this period of her life and the key people who started helping her with her plan.
So the principal person who helped her was this amazing woman called Tiina Jauhainen, who is a Finnish martial arts instructor and was first contacted by Latifa in 2010 when Latifa asked her to come to the palace and give her capoeira lessons. And she got just kind of sucked in backwards into this extraordinary saga where she found that this woman that she had been asked to teach was in fact a member of the royal family. And then as they grew closer over the years that they trained together, Latifa began to confide in her about what had happened to Shamsa, about her own imprisonment years before, and ultimately confided in Tiina that she was planning to try to escape again. And when Latifa told Tiina all of that, Tiina's first instinct was to say, I'm going to go with you. And then the second person was possibly a less advisable choice. It was this man, Hervé Jaubert, who was a former French naval captain and yachtsman who had himself escaped embezzlement charges in Dubai years earlier and written a book about it. And he'd escaped by taking a dinghy to a boat waiting in international waters. And so Latifa contacted him to see if he could help her try to pull off the same thing. And that's what they started planning. And so concurrently, Latifa was corresponding with Hervé, planning that he would bring a yacht to an area off the coast of Oman and that she would find a way to get there. And so she enlisted Tiina to help her get out of Dubai over the border into Oman and then out to the yacht. And then the plan was for Hervé to sail them to the US where Latifa was going to claim asylum.
So after all this planning, at one point before her escape, Latifa records a video message in her friend Tina's apartment.
And if you are watching this video, it's not such a good thing. Either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
So Heidi, she did this video in order to have this sort of documented, what she was about to do. And her friends, they drive her out of the country to Oman, hidden in a car trunk. They take her to a boat waiting offshore. She's on the verge of succeeding. And then what goes wrong?
Well, once this group of runaways have been at sea for about a week, things start to go awry. So first of all, the captain, Ebe, announces that he's running out of fuel. By now, they're about 30 miles off the coast of India. But he then notices that they seem to be being tailed by another boat and that there are Coast Guard spotter planes circling overhead. And before long, Latifa and Tina go down to their cabin and then they hear gunshots, boots overhead. The room starts filling up with smoke and they stumble out and find that the boat has been boarded by armed commandos who are all wielding machine guns. And they are dragged up on deck. And then Latifa is identified by these men and is dragged overboard, screaming, "Shoot me now, don't take me back."
Now, this all took place in international waters, and I understand India was enlisted by the Sheikh to take care of this. How was that allowed to happen?
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. And one of the kind of most astonishing things about this whole story for me is the extent to which Sheikh Mohammed is able to leverage his diplomatic relationships with foreign leaders, whether in India or whether in the UK, to just get away with the most extraordinary crimes. Sheikh Mohammed, having managed to use his intelligence agencies to intercept Latifa's communications from aboard the boat, then puts in a call to his friend Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, and they strike a deal by which the UAE will give up an arms dealer who India want. In exchange, India will send armed commandos and drag Latifa away and turn her over to Emirati special forces. And that was the deal that sealed Latifa's fate.
Now, another person who enters this drama, once Latifa is captured, brought back to UAE, isolated, then Mary Robinson, of all people, former president of Ireland and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. How did she get involved in this?
About a year after the attack on the boat, Latifa's friends have heard absolutely nothing from her. They don't know what on earth happened to her after she was dragged overboard. And then all of a sudden, these photographs emerge. They're released by the UAE, which show Latifa apparently having lunch with Mary Robinson. And afterwards, Mary Robinson gives a bunch of interviews in which she says that she has established through this lunch that Latifa is a troubled young woman with a mental illness and that she's safe in the loving care of her family, that she regrets the video that she made and everything that she said, that she was effectively kidnapped by extortionists and that she was rescued by her family and she's now being cared for at home.
But later on, Mary Robinson kind of has to eat crow. She realizes that, you know, she was had.
Yeah, right, exactly. So eventually when Latifa manages to smuggle out of prison where she's being held videos in which she reveals that she's being kidnapped against her will by her father's men, Mary Robinson had to come out and say that she was horribly tricked by the royal family.
It's now 2024. What do we know about where Latifa is now and what her life is like?
The real tragedy of this is, you know, that you can see, you know, thousands of messages sent by Latifa to supporters from inside prison after they managed to smuggle in a mobile phone and audio messages she recorded and video logs. You can see her spirit just begin to crumble away. And she, you know, she'd spent decades planning this and she'd said again and again that she would never surrender. And yet over the course of these years she spends in prison, she talks about how she feels she's just dying a very slow death by suffocation. She's not even being allowed to open the window. She can't remember what sunlight or fresh air is like. She just begins to lose the will to go on and she starts to contemplate doing some sort of a deal with her father. And then very suddenly, Latifa suddenly disappears. She loses contact altogether with her supporters and they can't get any word from her whatsoever for months and months. And then all we know of her since then is that all of a sudden, after the UN began making demands on the UAE to provide proof of life, a series of what appeared to be very carefully stage-managed photographs began to appear on social media. And statements are released in her name saying that she's now free and that she wants to just live a private life and she's very happy in Dubai and living there of her own volition. But she's never said anything for herself. And she's also never reached out in any way to Tina or to any of the other supporters who worked to campaign for her freedom for so many years. And so they find themselves in a real quandary because on the one hand, there are these statements coming out apparently from Latifa saying she's fine. And on the other hand, their standing instruction from her was, you know, if you don't hear it from me, assume it's a lie. Assume I'm still waiting for you to come and save me. And that's kind of where things are. It's a mystery.
Is there any ongoing pressure on the Sheikh?
Well, that's really dissipated. You know, I mean, again, such a frustrating facet of this is the extent to which the international community has been willing to kind of look away, really, you know, at the flimsiest sort of reassurance from Sheikh Mohammed. You know, he is back to the kind of stature he enjoyed as a major ally of Western governments. And yeah, no further questions.
I still feel like I have to ask kind of who is the most reliable narrator in this saga? In the end, who can we really believe?
I think that Latifa was an extraordinary kind of documentarian of her own life. And she left behind such an amazing paper trail and audio and video trail of what had happened to her. But also, you know, her story is just one of several. There are four royal women in Dubai who I wrote about and who, you know, our podcast talks about, who staked their lives on escaping Dubai and escaping Sheikh Mohammed. And in one case, one of those women, Princess Haya, was his youngest wife. She managed to get away to the UK and bring a court action against Sheikh Mohammed. And ultimately, the High Court ruled that Sheikh Mohammed had indeed abducted and imprisoned both Latifa and Shamsa and subjected Haya, his youngest wife, to a campaign of terror and intimidation and abuse. And so these are matters that have been adjudicated in court and findings have been made. And yet Sheikh Mohammed has sort of diplomatically anyway been able to brush these things off so easily.
Heidi Blake is an investigative reporter with The New Yorker magazine. The story she reported on Princess Latifa and other women from the royal family in Dubai is told in a four-part podcast series called Runaway Princesses.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Every year around this time, the city of Munich in southern Germany hosts a big international security conference. It dates back to the Cold War, and it's basically an opportunity for senior government officials in defense and intelligence, mostly from Western democratic countries, to get together and compare notes. Given the nature of today's security threats, there's also an invite-only conference all focused on cybersecurity. Reporter Dina Temple-Raston is in Munich for the event.
The Munich Cybersecurity Conference has been going on for about 10 years, and it's really a place for officials to try to figure out how they could tackle things like ransomware or cyber attacks and find a way to sort of attack them together. And this year, the focus was really on China and Russia. And that's partly because earlier this month, the FBI revealed that China was inside some of America's critical networks, like water and aviation, and was probably in our allies' networks, too. And then on top of that, FBI Director Christopher Wray announced here in Munich that there was an operation to push Russian hackers out of more than 1,000 routers in the U.S. and around the world. And the group they attributed this to, this most recent hack to, is linked to Russian intelligence, or the GRU, and they actually go by the name Fancy Bear.
It's the funniest name for a hacking group linked to the GRU. Doesn't exactly instill fear. What can you tell us about this group, though?
Well, a lot of the hackers that we're dealing with are just common criminals, but Fancy Bear is kind of a cut above that. And Bear comes from the distinction Russia, Moscow, Bear. So all the different Russian hacking groups have, there's Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. And Fancy Bear is one that is quite well known for using spear phishing and malware, mostly to promote the political interests of the Russian government. They were the group that hacked the Democratic National Committee and then released all those emails. And they're called Fancy Bear because, well, the code they use is pretty fancy. The interesting thing that came up at the cybersecurity part of this conference is how the U.S. and European partners are going to have to change the way they react to these kinds of attacks. Both China and Russia are changing the way they're targeting us and other adversaries. They aren't just stealing information or trying to hack into email accounts anymore, which is kind of what traditional espionage and cyber espionage was about. Instead, now they're being much more strategic and aggressive. They're pre-positioning themselves in networks in anticipation of some conflict they're expecting later. And that's a pretty different kettle of fish.
So they're trying to figure out how to address these changing threats. I want to talk about AI, something we're hearing a lot about here in the U.S. I understand the U.S. is talking to China about some sort of guardrails on the use of AI. How much has that been a topic of conversation in Munich?
AI has been a huge topic of conversation, and actually the Chinese are here in Munich. And we know from some reporting that we did that the White House officials have been talking to the Chinese, and they're in early stage talks about how to regulate AI, or at least to put up guardrails to know what is responsible use for AI. And the EU actually is leading the world on this. It passed some AI regulations at the end of last year that essentially create a kind of sliding scale of regulations, putting the heaviest regulations on AI that presents the most risk. So in other words, a self-driving car might have more regulations than, say, an AI-enabled thermostat. Hmm. So they're really leading the way on this.
Interesting. Dina, before we let you go, I do want to talk about the security conference itself, the longer-running annual event, which kicked off today. A lot of world leaders are heading to Munich to attend, but there are so many crises happening around the world right now. We've got Gaza, Ukraine, Sudan, Myanmar, and of course, other places with other conflicts. Where do they even begin?
Well, you have to remember that this conference was started in 1963, a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it was thought up in a time of crisis. Mm-hmm. And this is really an opportunity for leaders to be in the same place all together informally, where there's no drummed up communique that's required. And the press coverage of this event even is really circumscribed. Vice President Harris is here to assure European leaders that the Biden administration still has their backs, and that's just days after former President Trump said he'd encourage Russia to attack NATO allies who hadn't paid the bills for the alliance. President Zelensky is here, and he and the vice president are going to have a meeting tomorrow. And just to give you an idea of the mood, Navalny's wife was here, and she addressed the conference and said Putin would have to be held accountable for what he's done to Russia and what he's done to her family. And she got a long-standing ovation.
Dina Temple-Raston is the host of the podcast Click Here, produced by Recorded Future News. She spoke with us from Munich.
You've probably seen sculptures made by the American artist Jeff Koons. Balloon animals the size of a car, made of shiny metal. A topiary puppy dog, taller than a four-story building.
Or the statue of Michael Jackson and his dog in porcelain and gold leaf. They're in galleries and museums around the globe, and very soon, if all goes as planned, Koons' work will be on the surface of the moon.
All systems are go for launch of Falcon 9 with the Intuitive Machines lunar payload.
On board the latest SpaceX moon launch was some new work by Jeff Koons.
15 seconds.
Here's how Koons described this extraterrestrial art project when he announced it back in 2022.
Moon Phases consists of 125 sculptures,
each one representing a different phase of the moon.
The moon phase will be made out of stainless steel, brought to a high mirror finish, and then transparent color on top.
Sounding very Koons-like, all polished and shiny.
Each moon phase will have the name of an individual throughout history that's made a tremendous contribution.
Koons named his mini-moons after his earthly heroes. There's a Da Vinci moon, one for Shakespeare, another for Helen Keller. Cultural icons who inspired people, something Koons himself tries to do in this online masterclass.
Your experiences, your memories, everything about you, it's perfect.
Koons has been grabbing the public's attention for decades. Beginning in the 1980s, he was turning everyday objects into high art.
This piece is Train. Train consists of a crane and a steam engine.
This is almost like an Egyptian tomb. You know, the rug shampooers are like sarcophagus.
If you look at the lobster, it's a little bit like a performer, like an acrobat.
Some art critics complain that Koons' art is too commonplace, but gallery owners and auctioneers know that a Koons can command top dollar. His oversized metallic balloon sculpture of a rabbit auctioned for more than $90 million in 2019.
T-minus 10, 9, 8.
And yesterday morning, Koons' Moon Phases sculptures were blasted into space. A week from now, when the lunar lander carrying those mini-moons reaches its destination, it will be the first authorized artwork there.
Stage 1 propulsion is nominal.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend and join us back here again on Monday.
From PRX.